But Nanny's fears were unfounded, for the carriage arrived without incident in the yard of the minister's cottage. "Let me see the baby first," said Nanny. "It will be easier and fairer on Melina if I know what we're dealing with." And this wasn't hard to arrange, as Melina was out cold, thanks to pinlauble leaves, while the baby in a basket on the table wailed softly. Nanny drew up a chair so she wouldn't hurt herself if she fainted dead away. "Frex, put the basket on the floor where I can look into it." Frex obliged, and then went to return the horses and carriage to Pfee, who rarely needed them for mayoral duties, but loaned them out to earn a little political capital. The infant was wrapped in linens, Nanny saw, and the baby's mouth and ears were strapped with a sling. The nose looked like a knob of bad mushroom poking up for air, and the eyes were open. Nanny leaned closer. The child couldn't be, what, 3 weeks old? Yet, as Nanny moved from side to side, looking at the profile of the forehead from this angle and that, so as to judge the shape of the mind, the girl's eyes tracked her back and forth. They were brown and rich, the color of overturned earth, flecked with mica. There was a network of fragile red lines at each soft angle where the eyelids met, as if the girl had been bursting the blood threads from the exertion of watching and understanding. And the skin, oh yes, the skin was green as sin. Not an ugly color, Nanny thought, just not a human color. She reached out and let her finger drift across the baby's cheek. The infant flinched, and her backbone arched, and the wrapping, which was tucked securely around the child from neck to toe, split open like a husk. Nanny gritted her teeth and was determined not to be cowed. The baby had exposed herself, sternum to groin, and the skin on her chest was the same remarkable color. "Have you even touched this child yet, you two?" murmured Nanny. She put her hand palm down on the child's heaving chest, her fingers covering the almost invisible baby nipples, then slid her hand down so she could check the apparatus below. The child was wet and soiled, but felt made according to standard design. The skin was the same miracle of pliant smoothness that Melina had possessed as an infant. "Come to Nanny, you horrid little thing, you!" Nanny leaned to pick the baby up, mess and all. The baby swiveled to avoid the touch. Her head beat itself against the rush bottom of the basket. "You've been dancing in the womb, I see," said Nanny. "I wonder to whose music? Such well-developed muscles." "No, you're not getting away from me. Come here, you little demon." "Nanny doesn't care. Nanny likes you." She was lying through her teeth, but unlike Frex, she believed some lies were sanctioned by heaven. And she got her hands on Elphaba and settled her on her lap. There Nanny waited, crooning, and every now and then looking away out the window to recover herself and keep from vomiting. She rubbed the baby's belly to calm the girl down, but there was no calming her down, not yet anyway. Melina propped herself up on her elbows in the late afternoon when Nanny brought a tray with tea and bread. "I have made myself at home," said Nanny, "and I've made friends with your tiny darling. Now come to your senses, sweetheart, and let me give you a kiss." "Oh, Nanny," Melina allowed herself to be coddled, "thank you for coming. Have you seen the little monster?" "She's adorable," said Nanny. "Don't lie and don't be soft," said Melina. "If you're going to help, you must be honest. "If I'm going to help, you must be honest," said Nanny. "We need not go into it now, but I will have to know everything, my sweet, so we can decide what's to be done." They sipped their tea, and because Elphaba had fallen asleep at last, it seemed for a few moments like the old days at Colwyn Grounds, when Melina would come home from afternoon walks with lithesome young gentry on the make, and boast of their masculine beauty to a nanny who pretended she had not noticed. In fact, as the weeks went on, Nanny noticed quite a few disturbing things about the baby. For one thing, Nanny tried to remove the baby's bandages, but Elphaba seemed intent on biting her own hands off, and the teeth inside that pretty thin-lipped mouth were indeed monstrous. She would bite a hole through the basket if she were left unfettered. She went after her own shoulder and scraped it raw. She looked as if she were strangling. "Can't a barber be had to pull the teeth out?" Nanny asked. "At least until the baby learns some self-control." "You're out of your mind," Melina said. "It will be all over the valley that the little marrow is green. We'll keep the jaw strapped up until we solve the skin problem." "However in the world did her skin come green?" Nanny wondered stupidly, for Melina blanched, and Frex reddened, and the baby held her breath, as if trying to turn blue to please them all. Nanny had to slap her to make her breathe again. Nanny interviewed Frex out in the yard. After the double blow of the birth and his public embarrassment, he was not yet up to professional engagements, and sat whittling praying beads out of oak, scoring and inscribing them with emblems of the namelessness of God. Nanny set Elphaba down inside. She had an unreasonable fear of being overheard by this infant, and worse, of being understood, and Nanny sat scooping out a pumpkin for supper. "I don't suppose, Frex, that you have green in your family background," she began, knowing full well that Melina's powerful grandfather would have confirmed such a predisposition before agreeing to let his granddaughter marry a Unionist minister, of all the chances she had. "Our family isn't about money or about earthly power," said Frex, taking no offence for once. "But I'm descended in a direct line from 6 ministers before me, father to son. We're as well regarded in spiritual circles as Melina's family is in parlours and at the court of Ozma. And no, there is no green anywhere. I never heard of such a thing before in any family." Nanny nodded and said, "Well, all right, I was only asking. I know you're gooder than goblin martyrs." "But," Frex said humbly, "Nanny, I think I caused this thing to happen. My tongue slipped on the day of the birthday. I announced that the devil was coming. I meant the clock of the time dragon, but suppose those words unlocked room for the devil?" "The child is no devil," snapped Nanny. "She's no angel either," she thought, but kept it to herself. "On the other hand," Frex continued, sounding more secure, "she may have been cursed by Melina accidentally, who took my remark the wrong way and wept about it. Maybe Melina opened up inside herself a window through which an unattached sprite entered and colored the child." "On the very day she is to be born?" said Nanny. "That's a capable sprite. Is your goodness so exalted you attract the truly high-powered among the spirits of aberration?" Frex shrugged. A few weeks earlier he would have nodded, but his confidence was shattered with his abject failure in Rush Margins. He did not dare suggest what he feared. The child's abnormality was a punishment for his failure to protect his flock from the pleasure faith. "Well," Nanny asked, practically. If through a curse the goods were damaged, then through what might the ill be overturned? An exorcism, said Frex. Are you empowered? If I'm successful at changing her, we'll know that I'm empowered, said Frex. But now that he had a goal, his spirits brightened. He would spend some days in fasting, rehearsing prayers, and collecting supplies for the arcane ritual. When he was off in the woods and Elphaba napping, Nanny perched on the side of Melina's hard marriage mattress. Frex wonders if his prediction that the devil was coming caused a window in you to open, letting an imp pass through to spoil the baby, said Nanny. She was crocheting an edge of lace clumsily. She had never excelled at piecework, but she liked handling the polished ivory crochet hook. I wonder if you opened another window. Melina, groggy from pinlobble leaves as usual, arched an eyebrow in confusion. Did you sleep with someone other than Frex? Nanny asked. Don't be mad, said Melina. I know you, honey, said Nanny. I'm not saying you're not a good wife, but when you had the boys buzzing around you in your parents' orchard, you changed your perfumed undergarments more than once a day. You were lusty and sneaky and good at it. I'm not looking down at you, but don't pretend to me that your appetites weren't healthy. Melina buried her face in the pillow. Oh, for those days, she wailed. It's not that I don't love Frex, but I hate being better than the local peasant idiots. Well, now this green child brings you down to their level, you ought to be pleased, said Nanny meanly. Nanny, I love Frex, but he leaves me alone so often. I would kill for some tinker to pass by and sell me more than a tin coffee pot. I would pay well for someone less godly and more imaginative. That's a question for the future, said Nanny sensibly. I'm asking you about the past, the recent past, since your marriage. But Melina's face was vague and blurry. She nodded, she shrugged, she rocked her head. The obvious theory is an elf, said Nanny. I wouldn't have sex with an elf, Melina shrieked. No more would I, said Nanny. But the green does give one pause. Are there elves in the neighborhood? There's a gaggle of them, tree elves, up over the hill someplace, but if possible they are more moronic than the fair citizens of Rush Margins. Really, Nanny, I've never even seen one, or only from a distance. The idea is repulsive. Elves giggle at everything. Do you know that? One of them falls out of an oak and smashes his skull like a rotten turnip, and they gather and giggle and then forget about him. It's insulting of you even to bring it up. Get used to it if we don't find a way out of this quagmire. Well, the answer is no. Then someone else, someone handsome enough on the outside, but carrying a germ that maybe you caught. Melina looked shocked. She hadn't thought of her own health since Elphaba was born. Could she be at risk? The truth, said Nanny, we must know. The truth, said Melina distantly. Well, it is unknowable. What are you trying to say? I don't know the answer to your question. And Melina explained. Yes, the cottage was off the beaten track, and of course she never passed more than the curtest greetings with local farmers and fishermen and thickheads. But more travelers took to the hills and woods than you would credit. Often she had sat, listless and lonely, while Frex was off preaching. And she had found comfort in giving passers-by a simple meal and a buoyant conversation. And more? but on those boring days, Melina muttered, she had taken to chewing pinlobble leaves. When she would awake, because the sun was setting, or Frex was there frowning or grinning at her, she remembered little.
"You mean you indulged in adultery, and you don't even have the benefit of a good saucy memory about it?"
Nanny was scandalized.
"I don't know that I did," said Melina. "I wouldn't choose to. I mean, not if I was thinking clearly. But I remember once when a tinker with a funny accent gave me a draught of some heady brew from a green glass bottle. And I had rare expansive dreams, Nanny, of the other world. Cities of glass and smoke, noise and color. I tried to remember."
"So you could well have been raped by elves. Won't your grandfather be pleased to learn how Frex is taking care of you?"
"Stop," cried Melina. "Well, I don't know what's to be done." Nanny lost her temper at last. "Everyone's being irresponsible. If you can't remember whether your marriage vows have been broken or not, there's not much good in acting like an offended saint."
"We can always drown the baby and start over."
"Just try drowning that thing," muttered Nanny. "I pity the poor lake asked to take her in."
Later, Nanny went through Melina's small collection of medicines, herbs, drops, roots, brandies, leaves. She was wondering, without much hope, if she could invent something that might cause the girl's skin to blanch. In the back of the chest, Nanny found the green glass bottle spoken of by Melina. The light was bad, and her eyes weren't strong, but she could make out the words "Miracle Elixir" on a piece of paper pasted to the front. Though she had a native skill in healing, Nanny was unable to come up with a skin-changing potion. Bathing the child in cow's milk didn't make the skin white either. But the child would not allow herself to be lowered into a pail of lake water. She twisted like a cat in panic. Nanny kept on with the cow's milk. It left a horrid sour stink if she did not rub it off thoroughly with a cloth. Frex organized an exorcism. It involved candles and hymns. Nanny watched from a distance. The man was beady-eyed, perspiring with effort, even though the mornings were colder and colder. Elphaba slept in her binding cloth in the middle of the carpet, oblivious to the sacrament. Nothing happened. Frex fell exhausted and spent, and cradled his green daughter within the crook of his arm, as if finally embracing the proof of some undisclosed sin. Melina's face hardened. There was only one thing left to try. Nanny gathered the courage to bring it up on the day she was to leave back for Colwyn Grounds.
"We see that peasant treatments don't work," said Nanny, "and spiritual intercession has failed. Do you have the courage to think about sorcery? Is there someone local who could magic the green venom out of the child?"
Frex was up and lashing out at Nanny, swinging his fists. Nanny fell backward off her stool, and Melina bobbed about her, shrieking.
"How dare you," cried Frex, "in this household? Isn't this green girl insult enough? Sorcery is the refuge of the amoral. When it isn't out-and-out charlatanism, it is dangerously evil. Contracts with the demons."
Nanny said, "Ooh, preserve me, you fine, fine man. Don't you know enough to fight fire with fire?"
"Nanny, enough," said Melina.
"Hitting a feeble old woman," said Nanny, hurt, "who only tries to help."
The next morning Nanny packed her valise. There was nothing more that she could do, and she wasn't willing to live the rest of her life with a fanatical hermit and a ruined baby, even for the sake of Melina. Frex drove Nanny back to the inn at Stonespar End for the coach and four to take her home. Nanny knew Melina might still think about killing the child, but somehow she doubted it.
Nanny held her valise to her ample bosom, fearing bandits again. Inside her valise was hidden her gold garter. She could always claim it had been planted there without her knowledge, whereas it would have been hard to claim it had been planted on her leg in the same circumstances. She also had squirreled away the ivory crochet hook, 3 of Frex's prayer beads, because she liked the carvings, and the pretty green glass bottle left behind by some itinerant salesman, selling apparently dreams and passion and somnolence. She didn't know what she thought. Was Elphaba devil's spawn? Was she half-elf? Was she punishment for her father's failure as a preacher, or for her mother's sloppy morals and bad memory? Or was she merely a physical ailment, a blight, like a misshapen apple or a 5-legged calf? Nanny knew her worldview was foggy and chaotic, pestered by demons, faith, and folk science. It didn't escape her attention, however, that both Melina and Frex had believed uncompromisingly that they would have a boy. Frex was the 7th son of a 7th son, and to add to that powerful equation, he was descended from 6 ministers in a row. Whatever child of either or any sex could dare follow in so auspicious a line. Perhaps, thought Nanny, little green Elphaba chose her own sex and her own color, and to hell with her parents. The Quaddling Glassblower. For one short wet month, early in the next year, the drought lifted. Spring tipped in like green well water, frothing at the hedges, bubbling at the roadside, splashing from the cottage roof in garlands of ivy and string flower. Melina went about the yard in a state of mild undress, so that she could feel the sun on her pale skin and the deep warmth she had missed all winter. Strapped in her chair in the doorway, Elphaba, now 1.5 years old, hit her breakfast minnow with the bowl of her spoon. "Oh, eat the thing, don't mash it," said Melina, but mildly. Since the child's chin sling had been removed, mother and daughter had begun to pay some attention to each other. To her surprise, Melina sometimes found Elphaba endearing, the way a baby should be. This view was the only thing she had seen since leaving the elegant mansion of her family, the only thing she would ever gaze upon again. The windswept surface of Ilswater, the distant dark stone cottages and chimneys of Rush Margins on the other side, the hills lying in a torpor beyond. She would go mad. The world was nothing but water and want. If a frolic of elves scampered through the yard, she would leap on them for company, for sex, for murder. "Your father is a fraud," she said to Elphaba. "Off finding himself all winter, leaving me with only you for company. Eat that breakfast, for you'll get no more if you throw it on the ground." Elphaba picked up the fish and threw it on the ground. "Your father is a charlatan," continued Melina. "He used to be very good in bed for a religious man, and this is how I know his secret. Holy men are supposed to be above earthly pleasures, but your father enjoyed his midnight wrestling. Once upon a time. We must never tell him we know he's a humbug. It would break his heart." "We don't want to break his heart, do we?" And then Melina burst into a high peal of laughter. Elphaba's face was unsmiling, unchanging. She pointed to the fish. "Breakfast, breakfast in the dirt, breakfast for the bugs," Melina said. She dropped the collar of her spring robe a little lower, and the pink yoke of her bare shoulders gyrated. "Shall we go walk by the edge of the lake today, and maybe you'll drown?" But Elphaba would never drown, never, because she would not go near the lake. "Maybe we'll go out in a boat and tip over," Melina shrieked. Elphaba cocked her head to one side, as if listening for some part of her mother not intoxicated with leaves and wine. The sun swept out from behind a cloud. Elphaba scowled. Melina's robe dropped lower. Her breasts worked their way out from between the dirty ruffles of the collar. "Look at me," thought Melina, "showing my breasts to the child I couldn't give milk to for fear of amputation. I, who was the rose of Nest Hardings, I, who was the beauty of my generation, and now I am reduced to company I don't even want, my own squirming, thorny little girl. She is more grasshopper than girl, with those angular little thighs, those arching eyebrows, those poking fingers. She's about the business of learning like any child, but she takes no delight in the world. She pushes and breaks and nibbles on things without any pleasure, as if she has a mission to taste and measure all the disappointments of life, in which rushed margins is amply supplied. Mercy from the unnamed god, she's a creep. She is. She is. Or we might take a walk in the woods today and pick the last of the winter berries. Melina was full of guilt at her lack of motherly feeling. We can put them in a pie. Can we put them in a pie? Shall we, honey? Elphaba didn't speak yet, but she nodded and began to wiggle to get down. Melina started a clapping game Elphaba took no notice of. The child grunted and pointed to the ground and arched her long, elegant legs to illustrate her desire. Then she gestured to the gate leading from the kitchen garden and the henyard. There was a man at the uprights of the gate, leaning, shy and hungry-looking, with skin the color of roses at twilight, a dusky, shadowy red. He had a couple of leathern satchels on his shoulders and back, and a walking staff, and a dangerously handsome, hollow-looking face. Melina screeched and caught herself, directed her voice to a lower register. It had been so long since she had spoken to anyone but a whining toddler. "Good glory! You startled us!" she cried. "Are you searching for some breakfast?" She had lost the social touch. For instance, her breasts should not be staring at him so, yet she did not clasp her gown. "Please to forgive a sudden appearance by a strange foreigner at Lady's Gate," said the man. "Forgiven, of course," she said impatiently. "Come in where I can see you. Come in, come in." Elphaba had seen so few other people in her life that she hid one eye behind her spoon and peeked with the other eye. The man approached. His movements showed the clumsiness of exhaustion. He was large of ankle and thick of foot, slender about the waist and shoulders, and thick again in the neck, as if he had been made on a lathe and worked too briefly at the extremities. His hands, letting down the satchels, seemed like beasts with minds of their own. They were outsized and splendid. "Traveler not to know where he is," said the man. "Two nights to cross the hills from downhill Cornings, to look for the inn at Three Dead Trees, to rest." "You're lost. You've veered," said Melina, deciding not to be perplexed at his scrambled words. "No matter. Let me fix you a meal, and you can tell me your story." Her hands were at her hair, which once used to be thought precious as spun brass. At least it was clean. The man was sleek and fit. When he removed his cap, his hair fell out in greasy hanks, sunset red. He washed at the pump, stripping off his shirt, and Melina noticed it was nice to see a waist on a man again. Frex, bless him, had run to plumpness in the year and some since Elphaba's birth. "Were all quadlings this delicious, dusty rose color?" The man's name, Melina learned, was Turtleheart, and he was a glassblower from Ovals in little-known Quadling country. She bundled up her breasts at last, reluctantly. Elphaba squawked to be let loose, and without so much as flinching, the visitor unbuckled her and swept her in the air and caught her again. The child crowed with surprise, even delight, and Turtleheart repeated the trick. Melina took advantage of his concentration on the brat to scoop up the uneaten minnow from the dirt and rinse it off. She plopped it among the eggs and mashed tar root, hoping that Elphaba would not suddenly learn to speak and embarrass her. It would be just like the child to do that. But Elphaba was too charmed by this man to fuss or complain. She didn't even whine when Turtleheart finally came to the bench and sat to eat. She crawled between his sleek, hairless calves, for he had shucked off his leggings, and she moaned some private tune with a satisfied smirk on her face. Melina found herself jealous of a female not yet 2 years old. She wouldn't have minded sitting on the ground between Turtleheart's legs. "I've never met a Quadling before," she said, too loudly, too brightly. The months of solitude had made her forget her manners. "My family would never have Quadlings in to dine. Not that there were many, or even any, for all I know, in the farmlands around my family's estate. The stories make out that Quadlings were sneaky and incapable of telling the truth." "How can a Quadling to answer such a charge, if a Quadling is given always to lie?" he smiled at her. She melted like butter on warm bread. "I'll believe anything you say." He told her of the life in the outreaches of Ovals, the houses rotting gently into the swamp, the harvest of snails and murkweed, the customs of communal living and ancestor worship. "So you believe your ancestors are with you?" she prodded. "I don't mean to be nosy, but I've become interested in religion despite myself."
"Does Lady to believe ancestors are with her?"
She could hardly focus on the question, so bright were his eyes, and so wonderful it was to be called Lady. Her shoulders straightened. "My immediate ancestors couldn't be farther away," she admitted. "I mean my parents. They're still living, but so uninteresting to me they might as well be dead."
"When dead, they may to visit Lady often."
"They are not welcome. Go away," she laughed, shooing. "You mean ghosts? They'd better not. That's what I'd call the worst of both worlds, if there is an other land."
"There is an other world," he said with certainty.
She felt chilled. She scooped Elphaba up and hugged her tightly. Elphaba sagged as if boneless in her arms, neither fussing nor returning the hug, just falling limp from the novelty of being touched. "Are you a seer?" said Melina.
"Turtleheart to blow glass," he said.
He seemed to mean that as an answer. Melina was suddenly reminded of the dreams she used to have, of exotic places she knew she was too dull to invent. "Married to a minister, and I don't know that I believe in another world," she admitted. She hadn't meant to say that she was married, although she supposed the child implicated her. But Turtleheart had finished talking. He put down his plate. He had left the minnow. And he took from his satchels a small pot, a pipe, and some sacks of sand and soda ash and lime and other minerals.
"Might Turtleheart to thank Lady for her welcome?" he asked. She nodded.
He built up the kitchen fire and sorted and mixed his ingredients and arranged utensils and cleaned the bowl of his pipe with a special rag folded in its own pouch. Elphaba sat clump-like, her green hands on her green toes, curiosity on her sharp, pinched face. Melina had never seen glass blown, just as she had never seen paper made, cloth woven, or logs hewn from tree trunks. It seemed as marvelous to her as the local stories of the traveling clock that had hexed her husband into the professional paralysis from which he still hadn't quite escaped, though he tried. Turtleheart hummed a note through his nose, or the pipe as he blew an irregular bulb of hot, greenish ice. It steamed and hissed in the air. He knew what to do with it. He was a wizard of glass. Melina had to hold Elphaba back to keep her from burning her hands as she reached for it. In what seemed like no time at all, in what felt like magic, the glass had gone from being semi-liquid and abstract to a hardening, cooling reality. It was a smooth, impure circle, like a slightly oblong plate. All the while Turtleheart worked with it, Melina thought of her own character, going from youthful ether to hardening shell, transparently empty, breakable too. But before she could lose herself in remorse, Turtleheart took her two hands and passed them near, but not touching, the flat surface of the glass. "Lady to talk with ancestors," he said. But she would not struggle to connect with old, boring, dead people in the other land, not when his huge hands covered hers. She breathed through her nose to suppress the smell of breakfast in an unwashed mouth, fruit and one glass of wine, or was it two? She thought she might well faint. "Look in glass," he urged her. She could only look at his neck and his raspberry honey-colored chin. He looked for her. Elphaba came and steadied herself with a small hand on his knee, and peered in too. "Husband is near," said Turtleheart. Was this prophecy through a glass dish, or was he asking her a question? But he went on. "Husband is traveling on a donkey, and to bring elderly woman to visit you. Is ancestor to visit?" "Is old nursemaid, probably," Melina said. She was sloping downward into his crippled syntax in unabashed sympathy. "Can you really to see that in there?" He nodded. Elphaba nodded too, but at what? "How much time do we have before he gets here?" she asked.
"Till this evening."
They did not speak another word until sunset. They banked the fire and hooked Elphaba to a harness and sat her down in front of the cooling glass, which they hung on a string like a lens or a mirror. It seemed to mesmerize and calm her. She did not even gnaw absent-mindedly at her wrists or toes. They left the door to the cottage open, so that from time to time they could peer out from the bed to check on the child, who, in the glare of a sunny day, would not be able to focus her eyes to see in the house shadows, and who, anyway, never turned to look. Turtleheart was unbearably beautiful. Melina dragon-snaked with him, covered him with her mouth, poured him in her hands, heated and cooled and shaped his luminosity. He filled her emptiness. They were washed and dressed, with supper mostly made, when the donkey brayed a half-mile down the lake. Melina blushed. Turtleheart was back at the pipe, blowing again. Elphaba turned and looked in the direction of the donkey's serrated statement. Her lips, which always looked almost black against the new apple color of her skin, twisted tight, chewed against each other. She bit her lower lip as if thinking, but she did not bleed. She had learned to manage the teeth somewhat, through trial and error. She put her hand on the shining disk. The glass circlet caught the last blue of the sky until it looked like a magic mirror showing nothing but silver cold water within. Geographies of the Seen and the Unseen. All the way from Stonespar End, where Frex met her coach, Nanny complained. Lumbago, weak kidneys, fallen arches, aching gums, sore haunches. Frex wanted to say, "And how about your swollen ego?" Though he had been out of circulation for a while, he knew such a remark would be rude. Nanny flounced and petted herself, clinging determinedly to her seat until they arrived at the lodge near Rush Margins. Melina greeted Frex with affecting shyness. "My breastplate, my backbone," she murmured. She was slender after a hard winter, her cheekbones more prominent. Her skin looked scoured as if by an artist's scratch brush, but she had always had the look of an etching in the flesh. She was usually bold with her kisses, and he found her reticence alarming, until he realized there was a stranger in the shadows. Then, after introductions, Nanny and Melina fussed to get a meal on the table, and Frex put out some oats for the sorry nag who had to pull the carriage. When this was done, he went to sit in the spring evening light and to meet his daughter again. Elphaba was cautious around him. He found in his pouch a trinket he'd whittled for her, a little sparrow with a cunning beak and upraised wings. "Look, Fabula," he whispered. Melina hated the derivative, so he used it. It was his and Elphaba's private bond, the father-daughter pact against the world. "Look what I found in the forest. A little maplewood bird." The child took the thing in her hands. She touched it softly and put its head in her mouth. Frex steeled himself to hear the inevitable splintering and to hold back his sigh of disappointment. But Elphaba did not bite. She sucked the head and looked at it again. Wet, it had greater life. "You like it," Frex said. She nodded and began to feel its wings. Now that she was distracted, Frex could draw her between his knees. He nuzzled his crinkly bearded chin into her hair. She smelled like soap and wood smoke, and the char on toast, a good healthy smell, and he closed his eyes. It was good to be home. He had spent the winter in an abandoned shepherd's hut on the windward slope of Griffin's Head, praying and fasting, moving deeper inside and then further outside himself. And why not? At home, he had felt the scorn of the people of the whole claustrophobic valley of Ilswater. They had connected the Time Dragon's slanderous story of a corrupt minister with the arrival of a deformed child. They had drawn their own conclusions. They avoided his chapel services. So a sort of hermit's life, at least in small intervals, had seemed both penance and preparation for something else, something next. But what? He knew this life wasn't what Melina had originally expected, marrying him. With his bloodlines, Frex had looked primed for an elevation to proctor, or even, eventually, bishop. He had imagined the happiness Melina would have as a society dame, presiding over feast-day dinners and charity balls and episcopal teas. Instead, he could see her in the firelight, grating a last limp winter carrot onto a pan of fish. Here she wasted away, a partner in a difficult marriage, on a cold, shadowy lakeshore. Frex had a notion that she wasn't sorry to see him go off from time to time, so that she could be glad to see him come back. As he ruminated, His beard tickled Elphaba's neck, and she snapped the wings off her wooden sparrow. She sucked on it like a whistle. Twisting away from him, she ran to a glass lens hanging from the projecting eave and swatted at it.
"Don't! You'll break that," said her father.
"She cannot to break that," the traveler, the quadling, came from the sink, where he had been washing up.
"She just turned her toy into a cripple," Freck said, pointing at the ruined birdling.
"She is herself pleased at the half-things," Turtleheart said. "I think the little girl to play with the broken pieces better."
Frex didn't quite get it, but nodded. He knew that months away from the human voice made him clumsy at first. The boy from the inn, who had climbed Griffin's head to deliver Nanny's request to be picked up at Stone's Bar End, had obviously thought Frex a wild man, grunting and unkempt. Frex had had to quote a little of the Ossiad to indicate some sort of humanity.
"Land of green abandon, land of endless leaf." It was all that would come to him.
"Why can't she break it?" asked Frex.
"Because I do not to make it to be broken," answered Turtleheart. But he smiled at Frex, not aggressively.
And Elphaba wandered around with the shiny glass as if it were a toy, catching shadows, reflections, lights on its imperfect surface, almost as if she were playing.
"Where are you going?" asked Frex, just as Turtleheart was saying, "Where are you from?"
"I'm a Munchkinlander," said Frex.
"I to think all Munchkins to be shorter than I or you."
"The peasants, the farmers, yes," Frex said, "but anyone with bloodlines worth tracing married into height somewhere along the way. And you? You're from Quadling country?"
"Yes," said the Quadling.
His reddish hair had been washed and was drying into an airy nimbus. Frex was glad to see Melina so generous as to offer a passerby water to bathe in. Perhaps she was adjusting to country life after all, because Mercy, a quadling, ranked about as low on the social ladder as it was possible to get and still be human.
"But I, too, understand," said the quadling. "Uvel's is a small world. Until I to leave, I am not to know of hills, one beyond the other, and from the spiny backbones a world so wide around, the blurry far away to hurt my eyes, for I cannot to make it seen. Please, sir, to describe the world you know."
Frex picked up a stick. In the soil he drew an egg on its side. "What they taught me in lessons," he said, "inside the circle is Oz. Make an X." He did so through the oval. "And, roughly speaking, you have a pie in four sections. The top is Gilliken, full of cities and universities and theaters, civilized life, they say, and industry." He moved clockwise. "East is Munchkinland, where we are now. Farmland, the breadbasket of Oz, except down in the mountainous south. These strokes in the district of Wend Hardings are the hills you're climbing." He bumped and squiggled. "Directly south of the center of Oz is Quadling country. Badlands, I'm told, marshy, useless, infested with bugs and feverish airs." Turtleheart looked puzzled at this, but nodded. "Then west, what they call Winky country. Don't know much about that, except it's dry and unpopulated."
"And around?" said Turtleheart.
"Sandstone deserts north and west, Fleckstone desert east and south. They used to say the desert sands were deadly poison. That's just standard propaganda. Keeps invaders from Ev and Quox from trying to get in.
Munchkin Land is rich and desirable farming territory, and Gilliken's not bad either. In the Glickus up here, he scratched lines in the northeast on the border between Gilliken and Munchkin Land, are the emerald mines and the famous Glickus canals. I gather there's a dispute whether the Glickus is Munchkinlander or Gillikenese, but I have no opinion on that. Turtleheart moved his hands over the drawing in the dirt, flexing his palms as if he were reading the map from above.
"But here," he said, "what is here?"
Frex wondered if he meant the air above Oz. "The realm of the unnamed god," he said. "The other land? Are you a unionist?"
"Turtleheart is glassblower," said Turtleheart.
"I mean religiously." Turtleheart bowed his head and didn't meet Frex's eye.
"Turtleheart is not to know what name to call this."
"I don't know about quadlings," said Frex, warming to a possible convert. "But Gillikenese and Munchkinlanders are largely unionist. Since Lurlinist paganism went out, for centuries there have been unionist shrines and chapels all over Oz. Are there none in Quadling country?"
"Turtleheart does not to recognize what is this," he said.
"And now respectable unionists are going in droves over to the pleasure faith," said Frex, snorting, "or even TikTokism, which hardly even qualifies as a religion. To the ignorant, everything is spectacle these days. The ancient unionist monks and monts knew their place in the universe, acknowledging the life source too sublime to be named. And now we sniff up the skirts of every musty magician who comes along. Hedonists, anarchists, solipsists, individual freedom and amusement is all. As if sorcery had any moral component. Charms, alley magic, industrial strength, sound and light displays, fake shape changers, charlatans, nabobs of necromancy, chemical and herbal wisdoms, humbug hedonists, selling their bog recipes and crone aphorisms and schoolboy spells. It makes me sick."
Turtleheart said, "Shall Turtleheart to bring you water? Shall Turtleheart to lie you down?"
He put fingers soft as calfskin on the side of Frex's neck. Frex shivered and realized he had been shouting. Nanny and Melina were standing in the doorway with the pan of fish, silent.
"It's a figure of speech. I'm not sick," he said. But he was touched at the concern the foreigner had shown.
"I think we'll eat."
And they did.
Elphaba ignored her food, except to prod the eyes out of the baked fish and to try to fit them onto her wingless bird.
Nanny grumbled good-naturedly about the wind off the lake, her chills, her backbone, her digestion. Her gas was apparent from more than a few feet away, and Frex moved, as discreetly as possible, to be upwind. He found himself sitting next to the quadling on the bench.
"So is all that clear to you?"
Frex pointed a fork at the map of Oz.
"Is Emerald City to beware?"
said the quadling, fish bones poking out from between his lips.
"Dead center," Frex said. "And there is Ozma," said Turtleheart.
"Ozma, the ordained queen of Oz, or so they say," Frex said, "though the unnamed god must be ruler of all in our hearts."
"How can unnamed creature to rule?" began Turtleheart.
"No theology at dinner," sang out Melina. "That's a house rule dating from the start of our marriage, Turtleheart, and we obey it.
Besides, I still harbor a devotion to Lurline."
Nanny made a face in Frex's direction.
"Old folks like me are allowed to. Do you know about Lurline, stranger?"
Turtleheart shook his head.
"'If we have no theology, then we surely have no errant pagan nonsense,' began Frex. But Nanny, being a guest, and invoking a touch of deafness when it suited her, ploughed on. "'Lurline is the fairy queen who flew over the sandy wastes "'and spotted the green and lovely land of Oz below. "'She left her daughter Ozma to rule the country in her absence, "'and she promised to return to Oz in its darkest hour.' "'Ha!' said Frex. "'No haws at me,' Nanny sniffed. "'I'm as entitled to my beliefs as you are, Frex bar the godly. "'At least they don't get me into trouble as yours do.' "'Nanny, govern your temper,' said Melina, enjoying this. "'It's rubbish,' said Frex. "'Ozma rules in the Emerald City, and anyone who's seen her, or paintings of her, "'knows that she's from Gillikin's stock. She's got the same broad band of forehead, the slightly gapped front teeth, the frenzy of curling blonde hair, the quick shifts of mood, usually into anger. All characteristic of Gillikin's peoples. You've seen her, Melina. Tell him.
Oh, she is elegant in her way, Melina admitted.
The daughter of a fairy queen, said Turtleheart. More nonsense, said Frex.
Not nonsense, snapped Nanny.
"'They think she bears herself again and again like a phoenix,' said Frex. "'Ha and double ha. There have been 300 years of very different Ozmas. Ozma the Mendacious was a dedicated Mont, who lowered rulings in a bucket down from the topmost chamber in a cloister tower. She was as mad as a bung beetle. Ozma the Warrior conquered the Glikas, at least for a time, and commandeered the emeralds with which to decorate the Emerald City. Ozma the Librarian did nothing but read genealogies for her whole life long. Then there was Ozma the Scarcely Beloved, who kept pet ermines. She overtaxed the farmers to begin the road system of yellow brick that they're still struggling to complete, and much luck to them, I say.
"'Who is Ozma now?' asked Turtleheart. "'Actually,' said Melina, "'I had the pleasure to meet the last Ozma "'at a social season in the Emerald City. "'My grandfather, the eminent Throp, had a townhouse. "'The winter I was 15, I was brought out into society there. "'She was Ozma the Bilious because of a bad stomach. "'She was the size of a lake narwhal, but she dressed beautifully.' I saw her with her husband, Pastorius, at the Oz Festival of Song and Sentiment.
"'She is no longer the queen?' asked Turtleheart, confused. "'She died in an unfortunate accident involving some rat poison,' said Frex.
"'Died?' said Nanny. "'Or her spirit moved next into her child, Ozma Tipitarius.'
"'The current Ozma is just about the age of Elphaba, said Melina. So her father, Pastorius, is the Ozma regent. The good man will rule until Ozma Tipitarius is old enough to take the throne.
Turtleheart shook his head. Frex was annoyed because they had spent so much time talking about the worldly ruler and ignored the eternal realm, and Nanny lapsed into a bout of indigestion for which they all were very sorry, olfactorily speaking. Anyway, even being irritated, Frex was glad to be home. Because of the beauty of Melina, she was almost glowing tonight as the sun left the sky, and because of the surprise of Turtleheart, smiling and unself-conscious next to him. Maybe because of Turtleheart's religious emptiness, which Frex found challenging and appealing, almost tempting.
"'Then there's the dragon beneath Oz in a hidden cavern,' Nanny was saying to Turtleheart. "'The dragon who has dreamt the world and who will burn it in flames when he awakes.'
"'Shut up that superstitious codswallop!' shouted Frex.
Elphaba, on all fours, advanced on the uneven planks of the flooring. She bared her teeth as if she knew what a dragon was, as if she were pretending— and roared. Her green skin made her more persuasive, as if she were a dragon child. She roared again. "Oh, sweetheart, don't," said Frex. And she peed on the floor and sniffed her urine with satisfaction and disgust. Child's Play. One afternoon toward the end of summer,